Welcome to Twist, This Week in Sea Turtles.
Okay. This is Twist number 5. This is Michael Coyne, sitting at the National
Center for Twist Conservation Technology.
We did number 4 without you, Angela. You can speak up and talk now.
National Conservation Training Center.
Right.
Training Center.
National Conservation Training Center. A very nice facility. Earl Possert and Sandy McPherson have been nice enough to arrange for us to have International Sea Turtle Society Board of Directors meeting here. And with me is Manjula Tiwari.
Hello.
Donna Shaver. And Donna, say hello and then tell us where you are and like what your position is, who you work with.
Sure. Right now. My name is Donna Shaver. I'm the chief of the Division of Sea Turtle Science and Recovery at Padron National Seashore. And I'm also the Texas coordinator for the Sea Turtle Stranding and Salvage Network.
And we also have Thane Wibbles with us. And who are you, Thane?
I'm on the faculty in the Department of Biology at University of Alabama at Birmingham. And I do a wide variety of sea turtle studies and freshwater studies.
And we are all board members of the International Sea Turtle Society. And we have a peanut gallery. of other board members watching us. So we thought we'd take advantage of this opportunity to talk to Donna about exciting developments in the world of of the Kemp's Ridley. Donna in particular, because there's exciting news coming out of Texas this year in particular. Maybe you can give us a little synopsis of just a brief history of the Kemp's Ridley in Texas.
Okay. Well, Kemp's Ridley is a native nester on the Texas coast. Our first documented record of a Kemp's Ridley nesting on the Texas coast was back in 1948, before it was from Padron National Seashore, before it became a unit of the National Park System. And we've had sporadic nesting of Kemp's Ridleys on the Texas coast documented since that time. But there was a multi-agency international effort from 1978 to 1988 to try to reestablish a nesting colony of Kemp's Ridley turtles at Padron National Seashore as a safeguard against extinction for the species in case some sort of a political or environmental catastrophe was to occur in Mexico. The thought was there would be a safe area in the U.S. where Kemp's Ridleys could nest and be protected. So we began patrolling, looking for nesting Kemp's Ridleys in 1986. I began the program at the National Seashore. And we'd find anywhere between one nest every 3 to 4 years on the Texas coast up until about 1994.
How many kilometers did you survey?
Well, at Padron National Seashore, we were surveying all of North Padron, which is 80 miles. So that's where the patrol effort started back in 1986.
And the rest of the coast was sort of sampled sporadically?
Through the Sea Turtle Stranding and Salvage Network, right, through once-a-week patrols, or if there were reports of stranded turtles.
Right.
And also people related to the Stranding Network would be patrolling their areas for different reasons, bird surveys, marine debris surveys, and be looking for.
So what's the total length of the Texas coastline?
It's long.
Over 300 miles?
Yeah, it's got to be over 300.
It's a pretty long coastline.
Yeah. So, but beginning in 1994, our numbers started going up slowly. But in this year, in 2006, we had a record 101 Kemp's Ridley nests found on the Texas coast, and that more than doubles our previous record of 50 found last year. And 64 of those nests were found at Padron National Seashore. And that's the site of the long-term project to reestablish a nesting colony. And though there was nesting documented in other areas, where now there's also some patrol projects going, and also some areas rely on visitor reports.
How much of this nesting is by head-started turtles?
I was going to ask that. You got my question.
Actually, when you look at it statewide, it's a relatively small percentage. most of our records, when we do see the nesting turtle, and we only get to see the nesting turtle about half the time, most of our records actually are of wild individuals. When you start looking at some specific areas, though, like the upper Texas coast, where we don't have the historical records for Kemp's Ridley nesting, it's predominated by Head Started turtles.
And we should note that the Head Start program, a little background information about the Head Start program, anything you can...
Yeah, the Head Start program is one of the programs that was initiated back when the multinational conservation efforts came online back in 1978, where basically they'd take up to 2,000 eggs, bring them up initially to Padre Island, at which point they'd hatch them out there, and then they'd send them up to Galveston, so the National Park Service would hatch them out. Then they'd transfer them to the National Marine Fisheries Service, where they'd raise them for about 9 months and release them. And the whole point was they were trying to avoid the mortality associated with very small turtles being eaten.
Right, and the point of taking them to Padre first was to imprint them to the sand or whatever.
Basically, Donna was involved in artificial imprinting. And again, it's not really clear exactly why sea turtles come back to their natal beach, but... they were trying to cover all the angles, and so basically they'd hatch them out, let them crawl down into the ocean, and they'd scoop them back up and ship them to Galveston, Texas, where we'd raise them basically in containers
for up to 9 months. Anywhere?
Oh, yeah.
Great to see video of people the turtles and nets.
The Heartbreak Turtle has that in it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there was another group also, so the transplanting of eggs or hatching and artificial imprinting to Padre Island occurred from 1978 to 1988. Mm-hmm. From 1989 through 2000, there was anywhere from about 170 to 2,000 hatchlings that were taken directly from Mexico as hatchlings, never exposed to Padre Island, taken directly from Mexico and then brought to the National Marine Fisheries Service Lab for head starting. So there's actually two groups with different procedures.
And it seems, in some way, it seems like a real simple thing in that, you know, just like trying to stock, you know, fish.
Right.
But and other people will take it to the extreme and say, holy, you're really over-manipulating the species. But at the time they started that program, they were, for all intents and purposes, were assuming that the Kemp's Ridley was headed for extinction.
Right.
And they were going for last-ditch efforts in an attempt to basically save the species.
What, the low number of nesters?
Low number of nesters, 1986.
1985, 702 nests.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and realize
species, that's for the entire species.
And realize of the 702 nests, you have a turtle that's actually nesting multiple times during the nesting season, so you maybe only be looking at 300 or so nesting females.
But there were other recovery efforts going on at the same time?
Basically, there's always been protection down on the nesting beach, and that actually started before the international program.
Yes.
Yeah, Mexico has always had a strong effort down there.
So, and now, when you started in 88, right, your program? Or
78.
Okay. Not in Rancho Nuevo, but in the Texas coast.
Yeah, the Texas coast, with the taking of the 2,000 eggs per year up to Padre Island National Seashore was from 78 to 88.
Okay. But the program where you said you would find 1 to 3 nests a year?
Yeah,
actually monitoring Padre Island.
Right. That would be the number of nests found basically from 1948 up until... 93, and we started the patrols in 86. We didn't really see a jump in numbers after we started the patrols.
But those 94. Nests that you would find starting at that point, you were taking those and protecting them. You were taking the whole clutch.
Yes.
Artificially incubating it and then releasing all those animals into the sea.
Yes.
So you were getting hopefully a pretty high mortality rate relative to natural if you had just left the nest in the ground. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to a certain extent, starting at that point, you were protecting the few animals that that were nesting there. So, what do you is it likely that that has had probably a more significant impact on the recovery of Kemp's Ridley at South Padre? That just sort of has accumulated over time as you've protected those animals, since you're not seeing that many Head Started animals.
Yeah, we're on North Padre. Commonly confused with South Padre.
Oh, sorry.
We're up North Padre. I think we're seeing, actually there's four factors, I think. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing some of the return of the head starts, the Padre Island imprinted head starts.
Right.
Some of those Mexico imprinted head starts are coming back. I think we're also seeing some of the survivors from the turtles that had been nesting there.
Right.
And you know, possibly offspring from those first Padre Island imprinted head starts that may be old enough now that we got their eggs. but also some spillover of the overall population increase in Mexico, because we have had records of individual Kemp's ridleys moving between the two beaches, nesting once in Mexico,
oh, really?
And once in
mm-hmm.
Padre, oh, once in Padre, then in Mexico.
Within
yes.
a season?
Within the season or between seasons?
Within season and during different seasons.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Think about it. It's pretty well documented that these migrate along the coast.
Right.
And it's quite possible that some of them are heading to Rancho Nuevo. Just, you know,
they're ready to drop eggs. And
they
just
they go up. You know, so you'd expect at least some of that.
Yeah.
So now how does it appear that there's been a similar spillover effect along different parts of the Gulf of Mexico as well? You know, is there increase in sort of sporadic nesting
yeah,
in Louisiana, Alabama, Florida?
There's a few records from Alabama.
Yep.
Florida.
When you have turtles nesting yes. in or Kemp's ridleys nesting in Alabama, you know we're getting a recovery.
Yeah.
and there's some along the east coast of the U.S. as well. Don't have any records from Louisiana. Yeah.
There's not much suitable nesting.
Right.
But are any of these animals among the head-started animals?
There have not been any records of head-started Kemp's ridleys nesting anywhere except Texas and Mexico. All the others that have been
really?
Examined elsewhere in the U.S. have had no tags linking them to head-starting.
For the ones that they've seen?
For the ones they've seen.
Right.
Again, they don't always get a chance to
right.
see them and examine them.
Right. And the way they identify a head-start animal is that they have the living tag, right?
Right. Living tag, and then there are some others that are from the later year classes that also have pig tags and some that have coated wire tags.
Coated wire, right.
But you've got to have a $5,000 magnetometer to find the
yeah.
coated wire tag. So.
Right.
Do you want to explain the living tag?
Yeah, so the living tag is they take a little plug from the plastron.
Reverse
take
it with
a
carapace.
Piece, yeah. And they just reverse a little plug.
You have a color difference.
Right.
Where it's darker carapace and a lighter plastron.
That grows with them.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any indication of how long that's supposed to be? Well, I know when I was doing my work, the in-water study catching Kemp's ridleys, that we got some decent-sized animals, and the living tag was still very clear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a 45-centimeter animal, there was no problem telling that was had a living tag in it.
Yeah. They're pretty easily identified for the larger ones. Some of the smaller ones can sometimes be a bit confusing.
Right.
But
even in an adult nesting female, pretty clear when you have a head starter?
For the most part. Some of the smaller ones can be a little bit tricky to identify, but we also look for redundancy. All the head starts that I've seen have had very large tag scars on the right front flipper from the metal tags,
mm-hmm.
and also we look for the coated wire tags and pit tags.
Are there any historical records of what nesting may have been like for Kemp's ridleys in Texas? Is there a target or a goal for how do you know when you've what is the goal, I guess?
Yeah.
What is the eventual goal?
Yeah. Well, going back to the first part of the question, what the historic information, we don't have a lot. We've got reports from fishermen that say before it was a national seashore, they used to go out and regularly see Kemp's ridleys nesting and dodge them with their vehicles. And so they were out there before people knew that it was a big deal to report them. The goal ultimately is recovery of the species, and we're going to continue at the national seashore to try to do everything that we can to help recover the species. So we'll continue to patrol, protect the eggs, release the hatchlings, protect the hatchlings, and efforts will change as conditions change. The Kemp's ridley population is showing very promising signs of moving in the direction of recovery.
Is there a target number?
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
How would you know that the population has recovered? When would you say it has recovered?
Well, we're working on the Kemp's ridley recovery plan right now.
Right.
The plan that we're operating under is the existing plan, which is 10,000 females nesting within a season.
Correct.
To
that's 10,000 females.
Females.
That, now, that's the
that's
current plan. That is not the new plan.
Texas or overall.
Overall
okay.
in population.
Okay.
And we're working on criteria in the revision of the plan for.
And you have to realize when you say 10,000, that sounds like a lot, but the Herrera film from 1947
right.
has been estimated 40,000 females in one day. And so,
right.
That is not necessarily back to where it was. It's simply
right.
where you have a stable population.
Right.
And that was in the existing plan to get it to threatened.
Yeah.
Not off the list entirely.
So talking about the Herrera film, there was a poster at this symposium where they had asked different people to recount the number of turtles on the beach from the different shots. Did that change any of the conclusions?
To the best of my knowledge, it did not.
Who did that?
There's been several people trying to do that from digitized photos. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember who.
And they use different methodologies, right?
But
I know that Teresa Conant had sent out those photos to several people asking us to count and send in the numbers.
Yeah, actually, I'm not certain on that.
I'm not either.
Yeah. But like Donna was saying, if you go back to the mid-80s, you had 700 nests per year overall down at Rancho. And it's basically at that point they thought it was going down and it was going to potentially continue to go down. But then it gradually started coming back. And basically nowadays, they're just in recent years, they've neared 10,000 or gone over 10,000 nests down there, which seems like,
amazing.
Yeah, which seems amazing, but it's still nothing compared to what it used to be like.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at that sort of the classical graph of Kemp's Relief nesting through time.
But it is a clear, both Texas and Mexico is a clear example of how conservation works if it's done in the right way and if you put the effort into it.
Right. So now one of the things that you've been involved with, Thane, is sex ratios. That's been a big part of your work. And I know that I don't know what you would call it, but people have sort of played games with
well,
the sex ratio of the incubated eggs over the years.
Most of the time, unintentionally, I think.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, initially, it turned.
Generally, in sea turtles, warm temperatures produce females, cool temperatures produce males, and down at Rancho, they've always put the eggs into egg corrals to protect them from poachers and predators. And the logical thing to do is not put it down by the water because it's going to get inundated by the high tides. Mm-hmm. And so, when you put it higher up on the beach, basically you're farther from the water table. You're up in a And what they do is they clear the area so there's not vegetation, and so you basically have a warm egg corral, and that's conducive to the production of females. And so just let's say over the last, since 1998, we've been looking at sex ratios down there or predicting them. And they've done that in the past, too, and what we find is that generally in most years they're producing a strong female bias. And that's not the thing that's causing this recovery, okay?
Right.
What's causing the recovery is the protection of the turtles down on the beach, turtle excluder devices, that type of thing. But it's basically adjusting the slope of the recovery so that the recovery is going to be faster if you're producing more females and if males don't become a limiting factor. And there's no indication that males are a limiting factor. That is, we don't see any distinct signs of infertility. And so, quite frankly, by putting that egg corral up there high and producing mostly females, you're probably increasing the rate of recovery. And Donna's been doing the same thing. She's modeling her incubator's temperatures in similar fashion to produce a slight female bias.
So modeling them on the corrals in Rancho Nuevo or the natural profile at Rancho Nuevo?
Modeling them on basically what pivotal temperatures and which temperatures produce which sex.
Gotcha.
And so she's putting a temperature that's above pivotal temperature and thus is conducive to producing a female bias.
Right. Are you shooting for a particular percentage?
Well, I look to produce a female bias, and I aim for somewhere between 70 and 90%, and it varies from year to year, but it's consistently been female bias since we had the initial work in the very early 1980s that showed that we'd been producing a preponderance of males and then turned it around.
So the idea there is that you've got enough males, basically, that if they mate with one male will mate with multiple females, and so you don't have fertility problems. But is there a potential issue with creating a bottleneck, genetic bottleneck, on the male side?
As far as we can tell, Kitchler did some work on that, and she did not see any evidence of a bottleneck, even when it was much fewer animals than there are today.
Right.
And so there's no, let's put it this way, it's something we should be looking out for, but at this point there's no indication of it.
So diversity, genetic diversity seems fairly high, because she was looking at microsatellites, right?
Yeah. Another interesting thing on the sex ratios is that we had done it for about 5 or 6 years, and we were always getting strong female biases. And I'll say 80%, but it was actually greater than 80%, our predictions on female biases down Rancho Nuevo. And so we were beginning to think, they've always produced female biases, et cetera. Then about 3 years ago, we had the first bad hurricane year, and we had a good number of tropical disturbances come through the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
And all of a sudden, we got a big pulse of males,
right?
Okay, which was totally unsuspected or unpredicted. And it may be something, and you'd also predict that out on the natural nesting beaches. And that may actually enter into the natural ecology of these animals, right, where you've got a long-lived animal. Maybe in certain beaches you produce female sex ratios most of the years, and then periodically you get a big pulse of males, and that keeps enough males in the population.
Right. That's interesting.
But, you know, I guess that they've been talking about a similar thing with, for example, loggerheads on the East Coast, where, you know, changing the weather patterns. We've had a couple of years where we had a strong coastal upwelling, and it's really cooled off the coastal temperature. And so, you know, incubation times are longer, which means you're changing, you know, the environment of the and changing the sex ratios that are being produced. And that's interesting.
Yeah. I've got one student looking at loggerheads, and they find it's also you see geographic differences where, depending on which beach you're at in Florida, you can get male beaches versus female beaches.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you get over into the Gulf and up on the Panhandle, it's cooler. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense because you can probably get little microclimates depending on what the offshore dynamics are as well.
It's that and also sand and topography of the beach. Yeah, I mean, if you go to like the Atlantic Coast beaches, they're extremely steep and the turtles come up much farther from the water table.
Right.
Okay, and the Gulf beaches aren't like that. Plus, some of the Gulf beaches are very white sand and reflect a lot of light, and so they don't absorb as much heat.
So I heard something really interesting from someone who's been working at Rancho Nuevo for many years, and she said that this year in particular, they observed that the Ridleys were nesting higher up the beach, and they thought that this might be in preparation for the hurricane season. Somehow they got a sense of the upcoming season. Is that something you have observed at Padre Island too, that they're nesting higher up the beach?
This year we did see a larger percentage of them nesting higher. Last year we had several that were laid very low within the seaweed, and actually at the bottom of the nest there was standing water. So this year was higher, but I don't know that I'd go so far to link it to the hurricane season.
The hurricane season last year was pretty bad. I hope it's not worse
this
year.
So far it's been pretty quiet.
No, but it is very interesting. It is the same observation at Rancho Nuevo too.
Right.
The turtles nesting higher up the beach.
Right.
Our nesting season this year was very interesting. It was only on the Texas coast, only 7 weeks long.
Yeah.
We kept waiting and waiting for our first nest, and I thought,
so it got a late start.
Got a late start, April 26th was our first nest, and the first day we had 10 nests on the Texas coast, and then it just kept steady for 7 weeks.
If you go back 10 years ago, how many nests total did you have at Padre Island?
Oh, gosh. Don't recall offhand adding them all up, but it's been a significant jump. This year, 64 at Padre Island National Seashore. Last year, there were 28.
Wow.
So we more than broke the state record just at the National Seashore this year.
That's amazing, because the last year total, it was 50?
50.
50 total.
Yeah.
50 total. Wow, that's
but you're getting, you got as many in one day as you probably got in an entire season 15 years ago.
Even 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
So the recorded nest from the '80s, the 1 to 3 that you'd see, is that pretty similar to just the sporadic nesting that was at the same time was seen throughout the Gulf Coast? So those are probably just completely random, you know, sort of lost turtles from Rancho Nuevo.
I don't think there's a lot. There are very few records in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, Archie Carr was trying to find the nesting beach for years and years and couldn't find it. And there were some recorded nests in Texas and things like that, but I don't think it was very well documented at all.
So I know I've heard about it periodically, but nothing really steady.
Up till the 60s.
Outside of Texas, there weren't records elsewhere in the U.S. until the 80s.
Is that right?
From Florida.
Nice. And you guys have any questions to throw in here?
So did I understand you correctly earlier that the head-started turtles nest in a specific section of the coastline?
What we're finding so far is a geographic difference of the origin of the majority of turtles that are nesting. For South Texas, where we've got the historic nesting records, we're seeing a mixture of Padre Island imprinted, Mexico imprinted, and wild turtles. Actually, from South Padre Island, Boca Chica Beach, to the south of us, it's all wild turtles. As we move up the coast to Galveston Island, what we've seen is mostly Mexico-imprinted head starts, and they've had 3 records of wild turtles. So it's a little bit different of who's comprising those group of nesting turtles,
right.
The origin.
Does that have anything to do with where the hatchlings were released?
Well, it's an interesting question to try to explain why. The Padron and Printed Head Starts, all of the records have either been on Mustang Island, just to the north of North Padron, or Padron National Seashore, one record down in Mexico. Whereas those Mexico and Printed Head Starts have been distributed almost statewide in Texas, and then a couple of records down in Mexico. There's a difference of where we found the records so far of these different groups. And
that's
why
very
that
interesting.
Is, yeah. Don't know.
I'd just like to throw a plug in for all the people who've been working on it for a long time, as Donna herself, who have dedicated their lives literally to just being out there trying to find, monitor the turtles, save as many as they can. And having gone down to Rancho Nuevo over the past 20 years, it's amazing the effort that they do down there. You get more bang for the buck down there as far as, you know, the amount that, you know, they get a lot of highly motivated students who go out there and work on the beaches for very little money and are tremendously dedicated. And basically the joint U.S.-Mexican project through the various Mexican agencies and through Gladys Porter Zoo have been doing that for years from a very altruistic standpoint. And that's been a major factor in enhancing the recovery of the species.
Yeah, I'd really like to echo what Thane said. There's many, many, many people that have taken a part in helping the recovery efforts for this species in Mexico and many areas of the United States as well. In Texas, we've got hundreds of volunteers that have helped and many, many agencies and different entities that have helped out.
Right. Yep.
It's been a big effort, long-term effort.
Right. I was down there a couple months ago and I'd gone down with Pat Birchfield hires the various people down there and keeps very good people down there, or helps support the people down there, should I say. But one of the guys who drove into camp was Jaime Ortiz. And I think Jaime Ortiz was down there when I was down there in the 1980s. And now he's in charge of the Tepehuajes Beach, and he's still saving the turtles. And the guy's been there when it was almost extinct, and now he's there when it's coming back, you know, slowly.
Okay. That must be so satisfying.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, just to see, I mean, long-term projects like that, so that is very satisfying, that, you know, people are able to, clearly through a lot of effort, maintain funding, maintain interest.
The international components of this project are amazing. It was made possible by all the people that were involved. They were doing it, what I consider, for all the right reasons.
Right.
And holding an international project like that together and keeping it going for this long is extremely rare thing, okay? And so you can contribute that to, you know, all the people down in Mexico and Pat Birchfield and people like Jack Woody and some of the people who started out, people from, you know, Donna from National Park Service, various people from National Marine Fisheries Service who've been interested in it, et cetera. I mean, it's amazing to get that many organizations together and continue to work year after year for a common cause is pretty incredible.
So, Donna, for you starting out with this, when you first started out, was that sort of a personal project that you took on within your organization, or was that initially a task that you were given to watch out for Kemp's release and see what you could do?
I came to work at Potterell National Seashore as a Student Conservation Association volunteer. I saw the description of the work down at Potterell, and I applied for the position and started working there. Those tasks were already lined out, and I was a volunteer. But the plight of Kemp's Ridley was so dire then that, being a very young, naive student, I said, I want to dedicate my career to trying to help save the Kemp's Ridley. And
excellent.
People thought I didn't stand a chance and I was wasting my time, many people, but I stuck with it. And
right.
I'm just so thrilled that things
have
turned around.
You have to be, I mean, extremely pleased with the way things are going.
I'm very pleased.
I was telling the story the other night, and I'll retell it, but I was working for National Marine Fisheries Service on the Head Starting Project, and I ended up down at Rancho Nuevo one time, okay? And it was the time when Donna was flying down there in a Cessna 172 with a pilot to pick up the eggs for the Kemp's Ridley Project up in the United States, and the pilot was misinformed as he came in. And when he landed there and saw that he had to carry back all these boxes full of sand, okay, and full of eggs. He realized that he was going to have a real difficult time taking off. And I remember him asking Donna how much she weighs, and Donna did not weigh very much, but she was honest. The first time he said, I weigh this much, he says, I'm going to probably have to leave you here in Mexico. And Donna didn't, I don't think, had a passport with her, didn't have any way to get back out of Mexico, et cetera. And all I remember is Donna lost 15 pounds in about an hour and a half, because every time this guy would ask, the weight would drop down. And finally, I guess she was at a proper weight that he let her back in the airplane to fly back to the United States.
He didn't ask too many questions, obviously, about how he lost weight.
He
so
was
fast.
Very nervous about taking off.
Short memory. Yeah. So that, leaving it like a one box of eggs behind wasn't an option.
I think what they ended up doing was they flew down to did you go to Barra del Tordo and take off from a highway there and actually truck the eggs down, or that must have may have been
no,
a different year?
Mm-mm.
Okay,
no,
you flew out of that.
Yeah, we went with the original plan of this dirt road.
I remember Peter Pritchard flying in there with an airplane one time, and it was a twin engine with Roger Wood, who's a well-known freshwater turtle biologist. And to take off, they had to do about a 40-degree turn as they were running out at about 60 miles an hour. So they got up to about 60, and then they had to do a 30-degree turn down the other side of the runway into an open field to get enough speed to get out of that area. Yeah, it was amazing.
Awesome. So, Michael, you also worked on camps for your dissertation, mm-hmm. right?
I did, yeah.
What did you do?
We were doing an in-water study around the North Texas coast. So we were basically gill netting, using gill nets, which is very similar to what Donna did with green turtles at Port Lavaca.
Mansfield Channel, southern end of the National Seashore.
So very similar to that. And we did that. I started out doing green turtles down at South Padre. So we did that the first couple of years, and I think maybe 3 or 4 years working there and a couple places in Louisiana. And we were getting about 100 Kemp's Ridleys a year just caught in the water. And this would be anywhere from 20 to 55 centimeter animals. But that was really interesting work. And we were doing some sex ratio stuff as well, mm-hmm. taking blood, measuring testosterone, and laparoscopies on a few of the animals.
But you were finding a female bias?
Well, it depended.
Yeah.
there was a... I'm trying to remember now. It's been a while since I looked at that stuff. But the smaller animals had were balanced. Is that right?
But there was
a female balance or female bias as you went up in size.
But you also had head starters in, if I remember.
Yeah, but not very many. If you took them out, I took them out of the part of the analysis, and what you had left was, you know, say the 20 to 30 centimeter animals. There were almost the same number of males and females, and then as you went up, you got a female bias. And I, you know, hypothesized several potential reasons for that.
Well, maybe you had a pulse of one of those cultures.
No, that's exactly. Yeah. We've done a number of in-water studies with, like, Wayne Witzel down in 10,000 Islands and Jamie Berichevich up at Steinhatch in Florida.
Right.
And depending on what size class you're looking at, you can get different sex ratios.
The thing that I hypothesized that I think was probably the most likely cause, and if you look at some of the satellite telemetry work that people have done on smaller animals, not adults. Not smaller animals, but sort of large juveniles to sub-adults,
mm-hmm.
Was I was guessing that we were missing out on males, maturing males, because they weren't coming as close into shore. I mean, we were restricted to where we could fish for turtles. You know, we had to stay very close to shore because we were limited to 3 or 4 meters depth that we could put the nets in.
Yeah.
And so one of my hypotheses was that the male turtles, you know, maybe like a little bit of wanderlust or something like that, they moved around more, they didn't come in as close to shore. And so with the larger size classes, we were mainly getting females because of... just, you know, the males just weren't in that area.
Yeah, that's one of the tough things about studying sea turtles. Since they're out in the ocean, it's very hard to study their ecology and behavior. So you really don't know when. It's very clear as adults that males act differently than females and migrate at different times. But when does that start? And those are some of the questions we really have to fill in on the whole reproductive ecology of the species.
That's one of the things the sort of personal questions I have about the species that I'd really like to see answered. And, you know, you could get at that by doing satellite tracking across a range of size classes, and you could sort of try to pinpoint behavioral differences in movement,
mm-hmm.
You know, at the different size classes and between sexes.
One or some of Dave Owen's students have done some satellite tracking. Well, was that Kemp's?
No, that was down in Costa Rica.
Okay. Yeah, Pam Plotkin did olives.
Olives.
Yeah. But actually, well, Donna's doing adults now off a ranch in Nuevo and Padre Island.
Andy Landry's students have started up a tracking project again now. Just started up. Mm-hmm. They're doing
some
green turtles and some juvenile. Yeah, Aaron Sine is doing, she has some juveniles.
She has some juveniles and some adults.
From around Galveston, that area, the upper coast, right?
We'll see.
And I've been tracking adult females since 1997.
Right. Yeah. Donna's got some of the best information out there on behavior of adult turtles in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
Have you had
stuff.
An opportunity to do any males? Or is it just
yes,
females?
Yes, yeah. We've put out 25 transmitters down at Rancho Nuevo during two different studies on adult males. And I put one transmitter on a male that was caught incidentally in the Corpus Christi area.
Right.
And we found it's been interesting for the males down in Mexico. Nearly all of them remained resident off the nesting beach year round.
Where, oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
This is males and females?
The males of Mexico. And Richard Biles, years ago, had tracked some of the females, and he found them to be migratory, moving south and some moving north after the nesting season was done. And the adult females that I've tracked since 1997, almost all of them, when the nesting season was done, they moved out of the area, moving northward, some ending up off the upper Texas coast, off Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, or the west coast of Florida. The one male that I've tracked from Texas moved out of the area.
Oh yeah.
So,
How far did he go?
He's off the coast of Louisiana.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But Donna's work down at Rancho has significant management implications because there it's usually like a closed season during the nesting season for shrimping and things like that. But what her work shows is that there are resident males down in that area.
Right.
And as such, you're actually, if you shrimp during the winter, you're going to be catching Kemp's Ridleys down there.
Right.
So.
Catching the few males you guys are creating.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the males are important. There aren't that many out there. So
important.
We better protect them.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you also handle the strandings network for Texas. Mm-hmm. And what trends have you seen in the strandings?
We've actually seen some encouraging trends in strandings in Texas. We had peak numbers in 1994 and 1997, and they've generally been decreasing since that time. So that's encouraging
that's really nice. I mean, particularly with the population increasing, you would expect to see a corresponding increase in the strandings just because there's more turtles out there.
Right.
But you've actually been seeing
a decrease.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Do you attribute that to anything in particular? Or?
Well, I attribute it to folks working really hard to decrease those human-related stranding factors. Our coverage is just as good, if not better, than it ever has been. So I don't think it's an artifact of less looking for stranded turtles. I've been working really hard with the fishing entities, especially the shrimping community, and to make sure TEDs were in place and were being used properly, and there were enforcement efforts for TEDs, and I think that's played a role.
Right. Excellent. All right. Anything else? No? All right. Well, thank you guys very much for talking to us, and I just want to congratulate you on the great work that you've been doing.
Do you want to ask the audience if they have any questions?
You guys have any questions? No, everybody's shaking their head.
No.
All right, so that's it. Check us back soon. We've got pending stuff for, where did you go?
From Morocco and Gabon.
Morocco, yeah. We've got some audio already recorded, but we need to do something with it from Mangela traveling all over Africa.
And we also have the Cayman Turtle Farm recording.
Right, we have a pending report from the Cayman Turtle Farm, which hopefully we'll get to here soon.
And do you want to share the results of today's basketball game?
I mentioned that we're having a board of directors meeting. I think we said we're at the NCTC, which is in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and they have a very nice gym here. So we've had a little basketball challenge, USA against the world.
Three nights in a row after the meetings.
So USA against the world, and USA has been getting whooped.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. We won't mention the team members.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll put some pictures in the show notes. We'll make them as embarrassing as possible. All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks.
That wasn't too bad.
No, that wasn't. You did great.
That was excellent.
Yeah, you're the pro. I've done lots of media interviews, but this is a little different. This is all kind of like my dissertation defense.
Wasn't that half the nature?
Was it
new depth? New depth.
Yeah,
and so I thought I
That's right. That's what I said. Hey, that's not bad.